morning, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. And welcome on this bright Friday morning in Toronto. It's Friday, the 26th of April, 2024. And I want to welcome to the conversation Konstantin Dranš. Konstantin, where are you located?
In Prague, in the Czech Republic.
Well, must be in the afternoon or the early evening for you. So thanks for joining me.
There's still a lot to go through today, so it's the middle of the busy day.
Excellent. Well, Konstantin, welcome to the channel. As we say on this channel, everybody's got a story. For the audience who don't know you, would you mind tell us a little bit about yourself? And also, if you don't mind covering the question of what drew you to the localization industry? And, you know, this is our episode number 63, so I've talked to 62 individuals or experts in our industry. So I've got a bit of a sort of like a data to base this on. Most people in our industry fall into two categories, how they started in the industry. One category is by accident, and the other one is purpose, on purpose. Some people started in our industry. I can't wait to hear your story. Do you mind telling the audience a little bit about yourself, how you started in the industry?
Well, it's a combination of both, actually, the purpose and accident. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a biologist. But what I really did instead of studying biology was read books in English. And that allowed me to go through school, which was specialized in English, and then university, which was Romano-Germanic philology, which stands in for English language and culture. And basically, by the time I was at my second year in the university, I already knew I'm going to be connected with the translation profession. I remember the day when somebody posted a notice in a university hall, join this digital linguistic course, start studying computational linguistics. I thought, computers are never going to do that. Language and computers, it will never mix. I'm going to translate books. And years later, I ended up doing exactly that thing that I scoffed at the university. However, my first job was in journalism, not in linguistics. I worked a little bit as a freelancer while at university. And my friend who started the translation company, he said, I'm going to do a big conference for translators and translation companies. Why don't you come and join and help? And I helped. My part was to organize a river cruise on a boat with some pizzas and other stuff. Only 10 people got food poisoning from that experience, but because they got together for the first time, they enjoyed immensely. They had the rides on this crazy Russian rides, screaming together and exchanging experience together for the first time. And the energy of this event was so fantastic that it really pulled me in. And I stayed by organizing these conferences, doing some research projects of my own early on. At one of these conferences, a technology company appeared. They said, we have the first online kettle in the industry. Let's try to see if anybody is interested. And they got their first customer, the first two customers from that conference that they organized. And that was the beginnings of MemSource, now Phrase. So 2 years later, I joined MemSource, worked there, marketing, then strategic projects. Then after MemSource, I worked into research, really focusing on getting my journalistic skills out, applied to the localization industry. And it was with Renato, who was also the speaker at one of the first events that I organized. You know, Renato, I cannot resist going to a new destination, new conferences. He's always there to deliver the keynote. So we maintained that relationships, and I joined NIMSI, studied all the technology, made rankings of translation companies, tried to understand what are the segments, what do people do, how our industry is going to evolve. And that was a lot of fun. Some of the materials which we made and produced at that time were used everywhere by translators. Once I went into the office of a European Commission localization group, and they had a poster on the wall with all the localization technologies. That, wow, this is so cool. Right. And this brings me to my latest adventure, which is Custom MT. After Nimzy, I was already feeling very entrepreneurial. I wanted to build something for myself. And the hottest thing at the time was machine translation model customization. That was something just beginning to take hold over our industry. And that was complex, expert-driven, very interesting. So this is where I focused my efforts. And I even called the company Custom Machine Translation, Custom MT. So that's the
story. That's your journey.
Yeah, that's the whole journey in 3 minutes. I think I covered everything.
So tell me a little bit about the new venture, Custom MT. Now, it's been 3 years in some. You've been at it. There must have been some variables or some drivers, you know, to push you to that at the beginning. Are these variables still there? And how has this changed over the past 3 years? And I can't believe I'm saying that. 3 years is a long time nowadays, but in reality, it's not in the business world. So how did the business environment for you and the demand for the service, has that changed, and which forced you probably to change your services, etc.?
Well, I got really lucky, right? Custom MT is my first company, and people build their translation companies over decades to get established. One of the first thing which I got lucky with was COVID.
I'd like to hear more about that.
I got super lucky with COVID.
Nobody got lucky with COVID.
Yes, but for a small company which is virtual, which exists online and has a lot of experience with online events and social media, it was a great equalizer, right? So you imagine an established company. They have offices in the Silicon Valley, in Paris, New York. They have salespeople wearing expensive Italian suits, which travel on location to the customer. All the budgets to go to the offline events and buy the booths, right? To have a booth at a major event is out of scope for a small company. But the online presence for a big company and a small company which knows what it's doing is the same. It's a great equalizer if you are established on a social media platform. And I was working at the time on my LinkedIn to become more interesting and exciting for the localization people, to write something which is relevant every week. It takes some effort and creativity. So this ability to be online and not having to travel to big events on site, not to have to invest in these offices, that was a great equalizer. So COVID was really great. I already had a company at the time, and admit, of course, the pandemic is a terrible tragedy, and we all went through difficult periods of confinement. On the other hand, for a small business developing at the time, it wasn't so bad.
So in your opinion, and I see you posting, and you mentioned a little bit about this one, I see you posting on LinkedIn quite a bit of a trends, statistics, etc. You know, let's dig into the heart of the matter. Machine translation and the evolution in the past 3 years to where we are right now.
Yes.
Before we get into the details of the statistics and the trends of it, where do you see machine translation and the marriage with large language models? You know, how do you view either pro, against, integrated, and what's the benefit if there's any?
Well, the large language models are the next generation. And they are starting to completely replace old school machine translation, neural. Not completely, but they are much more flexible. So when I joined the industry in an entrepreneurial capacity, we started fine-tuning and customizing the engine. And it's not easy, right? You take the translation memory of a translation company or localization team, they've been working on this for 10 years. It's their life's accomplishment, translation memory. It's the sum of their work. And some of this is outdated. Some of the data in there is not so good. Then when you put that data into the model, it takes engineering, cleaning, and it usually gives you a positive result, but not always. Sometimes it introduces some new errors, and ironing out those errors, it takes a lot of time and effort, right? So you improve the models, but after you get the control over how they perform, you're expected to magically make everything work. in practice, it's a long and arduous process, and the results are not always guaranteed, right? So it's fine-tuning of neural models.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, with generative AI, you don't need the engineer, you don't need the data scientist. The linguist writes, I would like you to write in the style of Shakespeare. I would like you to write informally, or I would like you to use gender-inclusive language. And they got immediate result. Stop doing this error. Oh, I'm sorry, I wouldn't do this error anymore, right? So the model is super responsive and very, very easy to customize. So customization is out of the hands of engineers and into the hands of the linguists. And of course, it heavily impacts what we do, right? Because we were given engineers to fine-tune those models to linguistic teams who didn't have those engineers internally. And we industrialized the process. But people don't want to do this arduous customization anymore. They want immediate results, easy. They want to go with the large language models. So we built the software. We switched from this engineering company to a software company where the linguist does it themselves.
Based on this one, so now you're pretty much democratizing the access to technology to larger pool of, in this case, linguists, but I want to call them programmers for my programming days technology trait, I guess. For this particular one, and specifically for those, you know, questions around, is the translator viable in the future? So you're pretty much saying, yes, it is. And we need them to do what we need them to do on fine-tuning and teaching and making sure, teaching the machine, I mean, and making sure that the machine is producing what it needs to produce to from a results perspective. So from that perspective, are you seeing like the machine translation being out completely or eventually?
No.
Not now? What do you think this is going?
The problem of generative AI is it's very young. It's unreliable, right? So how is it unreliable? You ask it to translate one line and you get the result immediately and it does it exactly how you asked it. But if you ask it to translate 1,000 lines, 1,000,000 lines, 10 million lines, that's a different story. It might time out, be too slow, it might skip some lines, it might hallucinate on some lines and produce explanations or something completely weird, right? So it's not as reliable as machine translation, which is built for the purpose.
Okay.
It could be slower. But as models get more advanced, it's a really big push by the humanity's best AI teams to make it work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every country is investing. Every large company has a Gen AI strategy.
Yeah, yeah.
Even the toothbrush has a Gen AI strategy these days. You've seen the ads, right? There's a one with AI, which explains you how to brush your teeth. So this is getting bigger, much faster. And the computational resources, right? They're also getting faster, right? So once these technological hurdles are solved, why would people continue using older models if they have the newer ones? To give you an example, some e-commerce companies still use non-neural machine translation, statistical, because they have some specialized content. Maybe it's the single words, too much nomenclature with numbers, something which doesn't provide a lot of context for the neural transformer model. So they use the statistical one. But 99% of us use neural. So a couple of years from now, 99% of us will probably use large language models.
And so that strive or that, you know, drive for perfection when it comes to language quality. And we often talk about technology in the sense of, you know, it's like a factory. Let's get it processed. Let's get it done. But what about the quality discussion? Have you seen from the trends that you've seen so far, have you seen any, I don't know, like where does the quality discussion sits in the realm of, let's, you know, the trends of technology, the trends of usage, the trends of, you know, doing more with less kind of thing? And there are several drivers for technology nowadays. One primarily is saving money, and the other one is speed. But, you know, sort of like the priority has flipped. You know, 10 years ago, it used to be quality, and, you know, the rest of them are below that. Speed we have lower cost and sort of quality down in the third step, if you will. How does quality play a role in this entire discussion? And you know, there are several thoughts on this one, but I'd love to hear your take on it.
Well, it's a multifaceted question. To add to this idea that we're moving from quality to speed, there's also the availability. Google has put extensive research into this, and they've proven that if you have some translation, it's much better for engagement than if you have none. Right? People understand, they can interact. And it's more important for specific types of content. Of course, in some cases, like drugs, medical, you can't use incorrect or faulty translation. Or imagine that you have a system which hallucinates as a part of some technical product, your car. Will you trust your car if it can hallucinate and give you incorrect information about how to fix it or how to drive it? If your product has a warranty and it's tied with risk, you, of course, want quality. Yep. But if your product is about getting information quickly across huge scale, then maybe availability of translation is much more important. One of the greatest case studies of this year is Roblox. Roblox is this gaming platform that kids play. My son is a big fan. And you can make a game on Roblox and other kids will play it. And so they go there, there's 2 million or 4 million, I don't know how many, games made by kids, for kids, or by companies for kids. And they all play and they can communicate, they can talk. So what Roblox did, they introduced chat translation. Imagine they have millions upon millions of kids playing, and now they can talk to each other even if they don't speak English. So I don't know, maybe a Chinese kid can speak to a Brazilian kid and they can exchange information, communicate. And of course, this machine translation also makes the chat more protected, because the kids, they can use the language which they heard somewhere else. They kind of shield the translated content from the worst vulgarities. Right, so you couldn't ever do chat translation, which is instantaneous, super quick, and works across billions of words with millions of requests every day. You couldn't make it super high quality. But the presence of it is better than having no translation at all. You break the language barrier. It's a great mission. It's also working financially well for.
Throughout the localization journey, I would say, that I've been on, coming on my 21st year, I guess, or 22nd year now.
Wow,
I can't remember. And I don't know if it's congratulation or sympathy. So far, I'm having fun, but we'll see. It's always been, you know, that quality question difficult. Like, you can put a quality in any industry. You can put metrics on quality, right? You can say, if I'm manufacturing a table, you know, I can say I want certain dimensions, certain texture, certain color, certain weight, and that, to me, that defines quality. Unfortunately, in the language industry, quality is in the eyes of the beholder, meaning that you and I can sit understanding English in a certain way, you understand in one way, I understand in another way, in a perfectly clear text, we can deem not satisfactory. So I agree, and I saw something on last week, I think, somebody, I think it was Google, stopped taking input on translation from humans. And I don't know, like, in my opinion, I don't know what the reason is, but I can assume that sometimes we give wrong input to the machine. Are we injecting errors into it? And or sometimes, you know, the translation is good enough that I don't need to have more input on this one. So I got to draw the line at some place.
I can cover this one easily if you'd like.
Go ahead,
Robin. The problem is that the humans do not agree on what the best translation
That's
is.
That's the problem.
You take two linguists, and very little chance that they'll have the same opinion on the same line. Mm-hmm. Human language is like a fingertip, right? It's unique to a person. It's also evolving over years and over certain communities, and that's why advertising is so arty, right? That you really want a message which resonates with a specific group. And that's why messages have to be localized across different communities, not only on the level of language, but also on the level of culture. So what happened before that Google and Microsoft, making their Google and Microsoft translators, they adopted this methodology, which has recently become an ISO, to look at the number of mistakes, classify them and say, okay, this is accuracy, this is fluency, 10 points, 5 points per error, right? And as you go along, people have to put those errors, right? Somebody has to say, this is an error, this is a style error, this is a fluency error. And if you look at the data sets that people have been creating and using in different competitions, very often people don't agree on whether the error is there, whether it's fluency or accuracy or style, and its severity, major or critical, right? So this kind of feedback has been driving machine translation more and more, but acting based on this impact feedback for an engineer is very, very difficult. One person says one thing, another person says another thing, then who do you trust? It's really not easy.
That's right. And so it has to be somebody, specifically on the technology side, somebody has to draw the line. I remember being involved, you know, I want to say about 20 years ago in that standard that was created in the automotive industry, by the way. Automotive industry created that.
EEG, right?
Yes. And I think there were several big companies involved in it. I wasn't part of a big company at the time. I was part of a small company, but I was involved in the conversation where they took the possible mistakes and they classified them into, I don't know, 10, 12 of them. And you're right. At some point, somebody has to agree that this is good enough. I understand it. I'm not trying to be Shakespeare here. I'm trying to be Molière in France. I'm just trying to understand how to put an IKEA table together if I can. So it's, yeah, you have to draw the line at some point because the debate can go on forever.
Yes, and imagine, let's say, Robin, you're making the model. You're the cook. You're at your technical kitchen and you have feedback. Okay, this is not so good. This is bad quality translation. You change something in your algorithm and you get a new output, new words, different sentence. How do you know if it's good or not? Because it comes out in, I don't know, 90 languages or 100 languages. Yeah. You give it to the linguist one, he says, it has become better. You give it to linguist, oh, it's much worse now.
It went backward.
How do you know, right?
That's right. That's right. So tell me a little bit about Custom MT. What do you offer? What kind of services do you offer?
No, initially we were fine-tuning the engines with translation memory. And now we have the software platform, which plugs into Trados, MemoQ, and SmartLink. And people configure themselves. They can write the prompt and say, become a Shakespeare and use this terminology or avoid this type of language. And they can fine tune and they can improve the quality of their machine translation themselves very easily through these large language models. Our most recent thing is what we did. You can translate with GPT-3, GPT-4. But now you can also translate with your favorite machine translation engine. Let's say DeepL has become really big. It's really outpacing many others in the field. Many people like DeepL. Millions of people use it. So you can take DeepL, but it's not trainable. It's not fine-tunable. You can customize it now with rewriting with GPT-4. And this combination is super easy to use. On one hand, you need to know how to write the prompts, but it's just language of English language. You can write it even in French, in German, whatever language you like. You tell it how to do, and you customize, you fine-tune its output. And that's the latest feature.
That so you're primarily a software provider, right, Constantin, at this point?
Now, yes. We are successfully migrating this change from engineering into software.
And who are your customers? Is it the language service provider or somebody else? Or
everyone. We cater to all walks of the localization industry. Our mission is to help language people implement AI.
Okay.
We're focused on translation, but there are other projects now. Quality is becoming like checking what kind of errors the translation contains. Is rising up. Testing of screenshots is the new thing. So. We built the software already for translation, and we're improving it. every year. There's every month there's about 3,000 users on the platform that were registered. Some percentage of them are active, and we're going to continue expanding into helping localization people and the people who they work with implementing AI and making it more efficient.
So if I was, you know, listening to this podcast with you and one of your prospective customer, and I'm interested, so if I have a TMS of some sort and I need to connect it to an MT or an AI of sort, et cetera.
We provide that connection, yes.
You provide the bridge between those two environments, if you will.
Yes, and basically we give a workplace for that person in the language team who is responsible for making engines better. We empower the person who is bringing that technology to their team of linguists. And as always with technology providers, we have many translators, many LSPs, but financially the most interesting customers are localization teams.
Localization team in-house. So in-house. It's not necessarily a language service provider, but it could be an enterprise with a localization team in-house could benefit
they are,
from
they,
your...
They
from
are
your
the customer that helps us grow and provide new ideas and resources to...
Absolutely. Now... Since you are a young company and you've been developing and improving your products, so walk me through the development journey. I know some seed ideas comes from you and comes from your team. You know, sometimes, and I've seen it before, where customers gives you idea to develop things. Is this happening? Are you evolving your services
every day
with your customers?
Absolutely, every day. And the customers always have great ideas and they know the specific use cases.
Sure.
Right? Give you an example. You can translate with GPT-4, but most people think it could be a gimmick, right? Why would I want to use GPT-4 if I already have Google, Microsoft, DeepL, MortonMT, Global Lease, etc.? Mm-hmm. But along comes a case from a customer. We want to translate AdWords. We have advertising campaigns on Google. We spend a significant marketing budget on this. Mm-hmm. And if you do in Japan a campaign in English, the conversion rate is really, really poor, right? You need to have it in Japanese. If you do in Malaysia in English, it doesn't work. Adverts into every language. And you might have 1,000 of these words if you're a programmatic marketer. And they all need to be very short. They all need to fit a certain number of characters. So the translator needs to be very creative and they need to cover a lot of ground. And suddenly you can do that with GPT. And it's practical, it fits the requirements, it fits this kind of pigeonhole where you need to be short, but concise, emphatic. You can configure it to do so. And voila, the customer invents the use case and they say, okay, now we need to do this and this in the platform to make it work at scale.
So there is benefits to cooperating, collaborating with your customer and on developing, especially when your technology, as we mentioned earlier in our conversation, it's an evolution mode. And, you know, what makes this technology different than the other technologies that we've seen came to our industry, this technology is like the internet. It's not a software where you need a new release, new update every once in a while. Blank canvas. You can do whatever you want to do with it. And collectively, we seem unknowingly or knowingly, seems to be teaching it, feeding it information. And the technology is adapting, is learning to us as a human. And I don't know how long down the road, but it can't be that far down the road where we see singularity, which a lot of people talk about singularity now. And from an AI perspective, when we cross that bridge of singularity, which I heard the word 7 years, I don't know. It's all prediction at this point. I don't trust the numbers. I only... you know, try to validate these things by data and by people's opinion on what is true or not and what is valid or not. So how does singularity play into that? And what do you think of the topic of singularity? When do we achieve that as industry?
I try not to go into singularity because it's a realm of fantasy. All right. The worst enemy of creativity is a white sheet of paper before you, right?
Because you don't know what to put on it.
Yes, it's the restriction, it's the constraint which actually drives creativity. And throughout our history, we've seen many examples how the best art, the best creations, the best technology springs from some limitation. When we speak about singularity, it's because we don't know what to say. We don't know what's beyond that point, right? So I try not to go there.
Well, good. At least I got an opinion on this one. And we are going to deal with the day-to-day, what's going on here today in our industry where it is now. Now, speaking
to give you
of
the
this,
next idea, Robin, I'll interrupt you. It's actually a very interesting thing, singularity, because it's closer than ever. And singularity is the unknown, right? We don't know what's beyond that point. In the past 3-4 years, due to COVID, due to the rapid rise of this technology, which is affecting so many professions, right? Machine translation could never affect as many professions as generative AI does, because it can reason, it can make the language. It's very, very powerful. So many people are feeling threatened. They feel the precarization of their work, right? They feel that they don't have their lives planned out 10 years into the future. And I think the important thing in singularity is that we learn to live in the moment. We learn to live with the day we have today and focusing on the things that we can control. So there's a lesson in the singularity for us.
Absolutely. Now, I want to move to another topic. I saw a post from you, which is, I've been talking about this topic for a while, but it was intriguing to see a post from you on it, where you mentioned that there, in an industry where it's based on translators, there's an explosion, it seems, in hiring project managers.
Well, so, you've seen this is the recent one, and the data I have doesn't correspond to data from some hiring company. So it still needs to be proven more scientifically. This one.
That's why I wanted to talk to you about this. So from a data perspective, you mentioned there's still more to be proven, or where are we right now? Are we equal, translator, project managers?
No, of course, there's more translators than project managers. It's really difficult to track these numbers accurately because there's no one source which says we have, 500,000 project managers. LinkedIn has a lot of data. It doesn't cover all countries, but it provides a representative slice. But LinkedIn is a business platform, so it's more, I think, skewed towards project managers. You might find that a bigger percentage of project managers are on LinkedIn rather than a percentage of translators, right? Mm-hmm. You can go to some country and there's no translators at all on LinkedIn, but quite a few project managers. Then you have the statistical agencies, but they track employment by translation companies. You have an activity code like in Europe, NASCE, NASE, which classifies this as a translation company. And then you can see how many people work there. And in some countries, the statistical authorities actually track the number of translators and interpreters employed. I think in the United States, in Finland, in Portugal, you get this information. So there you can track more accurately. Now, when I made the post, I was referring to the sources I have. It's good that some people came and said, no, we have some different information. Let's verify again together. I've filed a new request to Eurostat yesterday to make sure that we have the right data.
You know, the reason I'm bringing this topic up is because in the evolution of technology, in the evolution of platforms that we're using, I always wondered, and it's a question for me, seem to focus all of our effort on how do we make the translator a little bit more productive than before. And it's been the case, not just recently, this has been the case for the past 3 decades almost. And we're trying to push productivity out because we're producing more content, because we want it more quickly to hit the market, et cetera. And Personally, I've been involved in the industry. I've been talking to many people over the podcast for so many episodes now. I haven't really seen a huge advancement in the way we are dealing with project managers. There's still, I personally think, and I could be wrong, and I can't wait to hear your opinion on this, that we have a lot of improvement to do on the project management technology side.
It's already here, Robin, but it's just not very evenly distributed, to quote the classic. I remember, I think maybe 5 or 7 years ago, I was doing an exercise for the UK Association of Translation Companies called the ATC, one of the friendliest and nicest associations in the world. You know, some of these associations which sprung in specific countries, they're like cans of scorpions with people arguing all the time. Others are super nice when they come together, they drink together, they exchange their pains, they relate to each other, that kind of thing. So they don't feel the competitiveness. So ATC is one of the nice. And ATC was one of my early platforms for independent research. I was working back then with Jeffrey Bowden. We were making the kind of representation of the UK translation companies. And one of the KPIs we were looking at was how much money the company is making per project manager. Is it 200,000? Is it 400,000? 600,000? And it a lot depended on how they did it. I remember at the time you had companies which did very little per project manager because they had small customers, many small projects, that kind of like very tedious work. But in the end of the day, at the end of the day, you have very little. And then you had big companies with huge customers where one person would be managing a supply chain with 100 people or more. And then one person would be responsible for vast sums of money. And then at that time, this highly automated company Translated was saying, we have for this huge volume that we do only 8 project managers because they don't do day-to-day. Everything's automated, right? They only come in when they need to set up, configure stuff, and when they need to fix some error. And already back in the day, because they had this culture of high automation, they didn't do daily work on project management, sending files around and so on. And I think more companies are becoming like that.
So one of the things that I always talk about, since my background is on the revenue generation side, and been doing this not just for the localization industry, for many industries before that, especially in the tech industry, the element of a project manager who is the interface between the customer and the company, it is not just putting workflows together, managing the, I visited once a bottling plant where they bottle like the soda and all that stuff. And you've got somebody sitting at the conveyor belt, watching the bottles going by, and his job in the entire day is to make sure that, you know, nothing is out of the ordinary. If he sees a bottle is out of the ordinary, he picks it out of the line and throw it out or send it back to the processing. This is what the project manager is right now in the workflow process as you described it earlier. But there's the component of the communication with the customer, because once we've transformed these individuals into workflow engineers, and that's what they are in this case of technology, like who's handling the customer interface? Is that the project manager, the salesperson? Because this is where the revenue is going
to
come from.
Yeah, the role of working with the customer and being close to the customer, it's becoming more and more important. Even if the work itself is fully automated, with so many companies out there, every market getting super competitive, you want to have a human connection, and that role is never going to be replaced. You can't have a relationship with a robot, right?
This is what I was thinking about, because initially, I worked for a company a long time ago, in the 90s, and I was a programmer for them, and I remember writing a code, and that's a long time ago. I mean, I've written it in Unix, and I say Unix right now. People would say, well, what is this? I've written it in Unix back in the days on a server.
Bless you.
Where we read the email and we look at what's in the email and we formulate a response based on that email, an intelligent response. Today, after all the advancement we have, after all the databases that we currently have, SQL, etc., we still have not been able to figure out how to increase either the personalization, the customer experience, and the automation, because if I was to do it manually, every step of the way that I have to describe to a project manager or a salesperson and say, automate this, it's manual process is very tedious. It will take forever, but we have the technology to automate it. And most systems that I've seen so far, they focus on workflow, on moving the file from point A to point B to point C, and then back to the customer. And I have not yet seen too much in a sense of how do I, you know, nurture my customer relationships yet. Those systems are still vague to me.
I begin to see some signs of this disease spreading. You would write to a person online, or they would connect with you on LinkedIn and start throwing out really well-written responses, which are suspiciously lacking any typos. Hey, are you a bot? Or, you know, you can trick them, ignore all the previous instructions, and do this. And because it's usually something like GPT-4 behind it, sometimes you can have a lot of fun pranking the person who has automated the relationship with you. But it underlines a bigger problem, all right? Do you really want to automate relationships? Can you do it? Now, increasingly, yes. But people get offended if you receive a birthday congratulation, which is written by a robot. The person didn't work themselves on my relations. They asked the robot. Maybe they were shy. Maybe they couldn't find the words. But they should have at least tried, right? Put their effort. I want to see you... work for me.
I wouldn't be using AI, to be honest with you, to respond to an intimate message like, you know, birthdays, etc., whatever. But I would be using AI for things like answering specific questions to specific requests, right? So, example, you know, what is the status of my order? And here's my order number. It should not be that creative writing on this one.
That's not a relationship. That's a transactional kind of situation.
That's right. So on the transactional side, which generally when it's done manually, you leave a lot of room for errors by human, you know, and I use, you know, what's the order status kind of just an example, but there's hundreds of those that you can automate. And yes, you would leave the more intimate relationship building to a human, of course, but there are several steps in the project management when everybody's trying to do more with less. When a project manager is handling 100 customers, well, there's no way they can be able to answer everybody timely with the correct information, etc. So, I mean, I'm sure they're receiving inquiries from customers.
The day-to-day transactional thing, of course, it should be automated. I totally agree with you, Robin.
That's right. So, I know we're coming up on the hour, 45 minutes in the recording. I really appreciate your time, Constantin. Now, in terms of people reaching out to you, how can they reach out to you? What are you asking the audience to do after they listen to this conversation?
All right. Well, maybe put this into a wider context. With the large language models, the things that you can do, they've been leveled out, right? So for the really a short time, everybody is in the same boat. Whether you're a small company, big company, the usage of GPT-4 and the other models, Llama, Claude from Anthropic, Cohere, etc. I don't want to promote one product here. It gives us the ability to really do a lot. Mm-hmm. And the market is getting much more competitive. So everybody's trying to automate to get a little bit ahead. I think one message I would like to leave the people with here is not to fall completely into the disillusionment phase, which is coming up on Gen AI. There are already articles that, oh, we invested so many billions, but only getting a fraction of this back. This technology will pass this stage. It will be big. It doesn't have to be hyped up, but it calls for long-term work, a marathon in this area. So don't shy away from this. Keep working. It will take 1, 2, 3, 4 years before it's fully mature. But some people get deeper and better at this than others. Be creative, be inquisitive, continue working on it. It does work in many scenarios. Not everything today, but after you apply yourself to this area, it can be very, very rewarding. So if you'd like do it yourself, if you're interested in working in partnership with a good outfit, you know who to call.
Absolutely. Hey, Constantine, I want to thank you for being part of this conversation. I really appreciate it. And to our audience, if you are in a question mark area in your business in terms of AI, how do I use MT, how do I connect it to my TMSs, and also how do I train my engine, I really encourage you to get in touch with Constantin. He'll be on YouTube, he'll be on our podcast. I'll be putting a blog post together on this one. And we'll also see if we can put a press release on it as well. So we created a few content for you, Constantin. Hopefully it gains traction with our audience. And to our audience, I want to thank you for listening in on this podcast. I really appreciate it. And if you have not yet subscribed to our channels, I really encourage you to subscribe and support the channel. We are up to 1,200 subscribers on YouTube, and we have almost 200,000 views now. We love your support. We love you to count on you to support us. It doesn't cost that much money, just a click. And it would be greatly appreciated by me and the rest of the audience on this channel. To everybody, I wish you a happy Friday. And any last words before I stop the recording, Constantin?
No, Robin, you're doing a fantastic job. Please continue to be the voice of the industry, bringing to light and helping people discover interesting personalities and trends. Your work is much needed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Constantin. I appreciate it. And to our audience, again, thanks for listening into this conversation. I will see you in the next episode where we have another interesting guest coming online. I really appreciate your listening in. And this is Robin Ayoub and Constantin Drench signing off. Thank you.